The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Resident Evil Extinction from 2007. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it an exciting dive into post-apocalyptic zombie-based video game-inspired movie making? Or are we just doing two Mad Max ripoffs in a row? We watched Resident Evil Extinction from 2007 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad I love, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project podcast, this time checking out Resident Evil Extinction from 2007. My name is Trevor Holland, the suggester of this movie and one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher, I suppose a victim of this movie. I don't know if that's quite the title to give me for this podcast, but thank you for having me back, Trevor.
Well, as long as it didn't give you the T-virus, I think we'll be good.
That'd be good, thank you. You never know, I might have wanted it after watching this movie, but we'll see. We'll have to see what happens at the end. Don't want to give too much away.
Absolutely. Now, if anyone out there hasn't seen Resident Evil Extinction yet, the third in the Resident Evil movie franchise, I have a synopsis of it here. Survivors of the Raccoon City catastrophe travel across the Nevada desert, hoping to make it to Alaska. Alice joins the caravan and their fight against the evil Umbrella Corp.
And believe it or not, thank God for a few of those references because, yeah, I was forgetting the movies that we'd watched before. I felt like I was going in so blind with this one.
How can you forget Apocalypse and the first one?
They obviously all blend into one another, but yeah, I was literally racking my brains trying to remember it. So I'll say I'm going in fresh with this one.
Fair enough. That's all good. Now, I just realised I closed down the awards page. That's not going to work out very well, because I was about to talk about the awards for Resident Evil Extinction. There are actually a few things on there. It was nominated for the Best Action TV Spot at the Golden Trailer Award, where it ended up winning the Best Action Poster. And at the Scream Awards, Mila Jovovich won for Best Science Fiction Actress.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say something else. I don't know what you were going to say then, but I do love how you said about those awards being for Best Poster Design and Best TV Spot. I don't know if that's saying something about the quality of the movie when they sort of trump the main feature.
Yeah. Well, at least be like, you know, got an award out of it and it wasn't a Razzie. So
yeah, exactly. That's always good.
Cool. And so that's the awards out of the way. Nice quick one today. And we will move on to our turkey trivia. Okay, so this is where we talk turkey about the movie and trivia. I don't know why I explained that. It's pretty much all there in the title. So this is actually rated 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb, so not too bad.
That surprises me.
It had a budget of $45 million. Its box office was $50 million in the USA, but it ended up grossing about $147 million worldwide. So it didn't do all that bad.
And I suppose it would have, like I say, with a lot of these series, it would have had that built-in fan base too, of not just the video game, but the people that had seen the other two movies, if they liked them and wanted to come back and see the third.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing about the Resident Evil series I've noticed is like it seems to have a very very split opinion. There's not too many people that are like on the fence about Resident Evil. They seem to like it or not. So we'll see how we go.
Yeah.
Okay, so to talk about some actual trivia about this now, apparently a decision was made early on to make this the bloodiest of the Resident Evil films so far.
Well, I suppose they had to do something to keep people's interest, especially being the third movie. You know, because when you're thinking about it, something that lasts sort of this many movies, you think, when you're basing this off a premise of a video game, you know, you're kind of stretching a very small story very thin.
Yeah, well, it definitely, I think as it goes on, it takes more inspiration from the video games rather than being based on the video games.
Oh, that's good. I was going to say, there's a couple of parts that come up and I'm like, you know, you can tell that's straight out of what the video game, in, you know, not being familiar with it, I'm not sure if you are, but, you know, I'm sure there's a few parts where you'll be able to say that's from the game.
Yeah, I basically played the first three and not much since then, so I'm pretty much out of the loop. I haven't put too much video game stuff in here, so there we go.
All right, cool, we'll get it out of the way.
Now, look, seriously, there's no chance that Mila Jovovich had a hand in this. I mean, the accompanying music for the first theatrical trailer was the Crystal Method's I Know It's You, which featured Mila Jovovich on vocals and performing Wailing in the song, which was released 3 years prior to this movie.
Oh, wow, okay.
And Alice's, Mila Jovovich's character, her costume was designed by Mila's clothing line, Jovovich Hawk.
Interesting, because when I think about her outfit, I'm thinking her wearing that very, you know, that sort of, that what you wear in the desert, essentially. And it doesn't strike me as something that comes from a, let's just say, designer brand. But yeah, so it definitely does sound she's quite involved with this. But I suppose, making sense, being the third movie, she really was the draw card.
Yes, this is this really is Mila's, I suppose, star vehicle, I suppose you could say. It's certainly, I guess, paid the bills for her for quite some time. Now, to get a bit of game referencing of it out of the way, Claire Redfield in the video games is in a continuous search for her brother Chris. So when the main plot of this film was planned, the original purpose of the trip to Alaska was to be the reunion of Claire with her brother. However, Chris Redfield's subplot was scrapped, and the voyage to Alaska was simply made as a quest for a safe haven.
Oh, I see. Oh, I've got a few things to say about the whole Alaska trip, and I'll get to it. But that sort of gives me a bit of an idea now. I'm wondering if they should have gone the other path, but hey, we'll wait and see.
Yes, we will. Oh, there's still three more movies.
Oh, no. I mean, yes.
Now, what I thought was quite cool was with the crow attack scene, which is one of the featured scenes in this movie, only two crows were used in the entire sequence. So the rest of them were special effects.
Oh, wow. Many times during that I was thinking, Hitchcock, you know, they owe a lot to Hitchcock, very much a homage, and a lot of the shots were very similar. I know anything with birds, I suppose, is going to have that familiarity. But, interesting. It's good to know what you can do now in comparison to the 60s with the birds, you know, to be able to make that out of two birds. Yeah, I'm pretty impressed with that, actually.
Yeah. I thought only two birds. Wow. And I think, as we mentioned in the intro there, this does share some similarities to Mad Max, and it may have had more because they originally intended to film it in the Australian outback.
Oh, wow.
But it was changed to Mexico, maybe to make it less like Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly. Considering, considering recently we've watched Waterworld, you know, which also felt like a Mad Max movie, so I thought we were just fitting the theme, but yeah, gosh, that would have felt even more like a Mad Max movie.
Indeed. Well, at least there was no people firing machine guns and laughing maniacally.
Yeah, leave that to Dennis Hopper.
yes, indeed. So before we talk too much more about this movie, though, I can see we're ready to go. We do need to set our baseline. So I went to Amazon and I checked out the reviews, and this is kind of what we're working from. The title of this review is Not Worthy of the Games or Other Movies. This is nowhere near as good as the first two movies. This was a big disappointment. First of all, the movies where there are just desert and sand really turned me off. They're boring and not much to look at. The zombies were very cheesy. Nowhere near being scary as they were in the first two. They don't look like zombies. They don't look like zombies when they run around quickly, nimbly, and attack with accuracy. And the main boss, in air quotes, of the movie, who was supposed to give fans what they want in a Resident Evil movie, fell flat. I don't want to spoil it for you, but you'll see. Nowhere near what the games produced. The problem with this movie was the pace and the story. It was somewhere between The Road Warrior, which was a better post-apocalyptic movie than this one, and Day of the Dead. If you are familiar with the original Day of the Dead, you will see what I mean. One star.
Oh, wow. There was a lot of times I was nodding there. And yeah, the Day of the Dead reference, yeah, it came up quite a lot. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the third film in the Romero trilogy, but yeah, a lot of, let's just say, you know, they're in an army bunker and they're experimenting on zombies and they bite the guy who works there and then he turns into a zombie. Sound familiar?
yes, indeed. Well, I mean, really, the Resident Evil series was, I suppose the movie series was originally very much inspired by George Romero, and if I remember back to a turkey trivia from over 2 years ago now, I guess, they were looking at Romero to direct.
Oh, okay. And I suppose, too, I think like we've said with a lot of zombie things in the past, too, like I think anything owes its debt to Romero because he's the original creator of the zombie genre, I suppose. So, yeah, I think that makes sense. Definitely a homage as well. But interesting if he was to direct, especially it being very similar to his other movie. But that's interesting.
Mm, absolutely. What might have been.
I know. But we've got exists.
Yeah, let's talk about what we've got.
Yeah, exactly. And then one thing I love, Trevor, oh, thank you for choosing a short movie. That's what I laughed about in that review when they're talking about the pace. I know a short movie can still have bad pacing, but at least it's short enough that it didn't sort of outstay its welcome too much.
Yeah, I love seeing a running time that's only in double digits.
Oh,
that's always a good feeling. Yeah. 94 minutes, that's not too bad.
And now that I'm starting to realise, or not starting to realise, I've realised that most credits go for between 7 and 10 minutes. Yeah, you're pretty safe. You've got a smaller movie there, which is good. So, yeah, it's short and sweet, and it felt like that, thankfully.
Yeah, and talking about short and sweet, I mean, it starts up straight to the spooky music.
Oh,
not for very long.
Yeah, I actually liked that. I've actually got creepy music here. Yep, so we're thinking the same thing. I kind of liked that creepy music. And then, within, I think it was 30 seconds, and we get the eye of Miller and straight open. You know, it's funny, you know what audience this is obviously targeted for, because our opening scene is Miller naked in a tub.
Yeah, which mirrors, and like this whole sequence mirrors the start of the very first movie, where she wakes up. So it's like, I've got here, waking up in a shower again, getting in the right outfit, the nice red dress.
Yep.
Again. Try, and I think they even had a similar sequence in the second movie. So they're trying to make a sync with watching the first movie again.
Well,
got to have a laser grid again.
Well, that's the thing. I said to you, I can't really remember the other two that well, but there were moments like that that would come up, and I'm like, I remember that. And especially when the zombie dogs came out, I'm like, oh, that's right.
I remember them featuring dogs.
I remember them featuring quite a lot in the last chat. So it was all sort of slowly coming back to me. But yeah, I thought it was very much. It didn't waste any time getting into it, which is fantastic. And I suppose that's what you expect from a video game movie.
Mm-hmm. But I tell you what, that base/hospital/secret science center, it really is not a very safe working environment.
Definitely not. And it's like, it's all about the experiments, but not about the safety of the people working there. But the first thing I think is as soon as Miller gets the red dress on and is walking around with the gun and all that sort of thing, I'm like, we're back to, I think it was the first movie, which was pretty much an hour and a half of her walking through halls with a gun. And I felt like we were back in that territory again. But that happens quite a lot in this movie, even though, yeah, they're right, the pacing is quite strange, but I'm stepping ahead of myself. But yeah, but I do like, I appreciate a lot of the traps set up around the hospital, and I did like that hall of light beams and all that. Like, as you said, that had been used before. But yeah, there were some really clever, I don't know, visual design aspects. And I think you take what you can in an apocalyptic movie, because they're usually quite drab.
Well, they certainly didn't waste too much time in making you think that this might be a very short movie if you hadn't watched a trailer, where Alice gets rather quickly and brutally killed again within the first 5 minutes of the movie, and that's when you find out, oh, it was a clone of Alice, and she gets dumped in a trench full of dead Alices.
I did like that shot where it pulls out and it's all the different Mila Jovovich. At first I thought it was sort of, before it started zooming out, I thought, oh, it's going to be sort of all doppelgangers or something. I'm like, oh, no, it is all Mila Jovovich or all Alice. So, yeah, that was, you know, clever things like that. But it's funny how it goes straight from that. It's almost like that's a little, a little intro. And then I think the credits came up then, and then they did the recap. So it was kind of cool. They had that little, I suppose, pre-credits action.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to refer to her as Alice or Mila throughout this, okay, because I don't want to keep butchering her surname of Jovovich.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I have to think about it every time I say it.
Let's go with Alice. You know, that works yes. too. And it's funny because I think halfway through the movie there's a reference to Project Alice because I'd forgotten that was her name. And I remember the other movies, there was supposed to be references to Alice in Wonderland. So I was also trying to find as many connections and references as I could. So I might have been overthinking it for this one.
Yeah, well, I mean, the artificial intelligence in the first movie was called the Red Queen, and in this one, even though they never refer to her as by name, we have the White Queen, is the little girl artificial intelligence that pops up from time to time.
Yes, yeah. Even though it looks very much like a reject from The Ring, possibly. That's what I was thinking the whole time.
Let's go for a little girl with long, straight black hair because they're always slightly creepy.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I did see, especially when the bad guy, I can't remember his name, he's wearing all white too. It was very similar to, I think, the White Knight, not the White Knight, but the White King or whatever from Alice Through the Looking Glass. So yeah, so there are little subliminal things there possibly, or you can probably read into it more than that. So, but yeah, I did appreciate that, as I said before, when it got to the recap, and it kind of gave us a bit of a recap about the virus. Pretty much wiped out Earth.
Yeah, but yeah, good old Ian Glenn. He's appeared a few times in us as usually as bad guys. I'm pretty sure he was a bad guy in one of the Tomb Raider movies. Yes, he was indeed. He was a bad guy in the Lara Croft Tomb Raider movie, which we've already covered.
Yeah. Well, I thought he looked very familiar. And yeah, it's funny how those sort of guys end up sort of, so typecast in those sort of roles. But he seemed to be lapping it up or what he could do with. That's the thing about these movies. They have very limited dialogue and limited character development because of their bases. So a lot of times they're just working with what they can.
Indeed. Oh, he comes back for the final chapter as well. Ooh.
More to look forward to.
So I'm just looking at Ian Glenn's IMDb page here. But Dr. Isaacs, yes, he's a very... definitely goes straight for the super calm and quietly evil and rebellious stereotype.
Yeah, and so many Dr. Evil and sort of, well, I suppose, James Bond villain references there. So, but yeah, as I said, you don't have much to work with these characters, so you do what you can.
Yeah, there's definitely more about setting up. I think it's more about setting up what happens to them rather than setting up the characters.
But one thing I noticed about this movie, even though, I'm probably jumping ahead a bit, but even though it being a short movie, it took a while to sort of set everything up. Not saying that it dragged in that respect, but, when you mentioned in that, the plot summary about them going to Alaska, you're sort of intending that to be the sort of main plot point. But it takes quite a while for them to start trekking off to Alaska because, of course, they've got to set up and all this other stuff has to happen. But I just felt that it could have come in a little bit earlier so that it could have been more of a journey. Kind of like playing the game where you start in one thing, end up in another destination and have to fight all these things along the way. But I think they just wanted to give us an action and a bit of backstory, but for the first 30 minutes it's pretty much that. So I don't know, I felt they should have got into it a bit quicker.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they have quite a jump, because I think at the end of the last movie, like, Alice and her band of survivors have just escaped the clutches of Umbrella. So between the end of that movie and the start of this movie, the virus is spread worldwide. Not only does it affect people, it also affects the Earth itself and it's caused like a massive worldwide drought for some reason, because plot points. And then so when we do cut to the real Alice out in her dusted jacket riding her motorbike through the desert, we get a little bit of the compulsory verbal exposition as is required at the start of these movies to get there, and we finally have her roll into like an abandoned petrol station looking for fuel. So you can tell to try to imply the fact that it's been quite some time. So I think that kind of works against it at the start, in that they do have a lot to establish between the end of the second movie and the start of this one.
And I think, too, the way that they tend to make these movies is to still be a standalone movie as well. So if you are coming in fresh, say, like me, who can't remember the other two, you can, you can at least be caught up pretty easily, and it's, you're not feeling like you missed out on too much. But I can understand why that one-star review that you mentioned earlier, where they mentioned, boring, all those scenes of the desert. But obviously, once you realise what the plot point is, of course, that's what we're dealing with here. But Trevor, I had to laugh. You've got to have a desert scene with a tumbleweed. It's just I laughed to myself. I'm like, of course. And then they threw a couple more in. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. You've established where you are. Mm-hmm. And having driven through the Nevada desert a few months ago, you know, I could relate to a lot of the stuff that you were seeing. Of course, not a post-apocalyptic version of America, but that scenery was very familiar.
Fair enough. But she rocks up to that town because another nice post-apocalyptic trope is where you have people radioing looking for assistance or survivors, but she rocks up and, oh no, it's a trap. I don't see the point. I actually don't see the point of this band of survivors setting up these traps for the people who come by, because eventually they'd get like a whole group come in. I mean, who'd be a problem. I mean, it just seemed an odd setup for not much good point other than to justify dropping Mila Jovovich, dropping Ellis into a pit so we can have our zombie dogs.
Yeah, which incidentally look like dogs covered in tomato sauce. I don't know what you were thinking.
I think another thing of the series is that those dogs are always dogs covered in makeup,
rather than
being CGI dogs, which is a nice touch.
It's pretty cool, but I can just imagine the filming of that. That would have been quite funny. Miller, we'll say, as the actress would have been. She's probably got meat in her pocket or something like that to make them chase after her. But I know what you mean about that gang. I was sort of wondering where it was all going to go. But as you said, it was pretty much just setting up those traps and the zombie dogs. But it's funny how you're saying, how would they be prepared if a big group of people came through? And I think to myself, well, you only have to have a few bumps from a zombie dog and your entire thing collapses and you conveniently fall into or the dogs attack you. So it wasn't very reliable for them.
It was choreographed quite well, how she manages to rope the dogs together and tie them to a pillar and then uses the zombie dog's extra strength, I guess, to pull the pillar out from underneath the guys up top to make a handier ramp for herself. But again, like the whole point of this thing was just like, okay, we need the zombie dogs. Let's get them out of the way. Because they are a series staple. And then that also gives us an excuse for Mila to just go through, get her guns back, and also pick up a couple of handy meat cleavers or whatever those knives were. So we can have stylish combat later in the movie for
them. Yeah, and I suppose that's probably what people are all expecting. And that's the thing, whenever Miller gets it, or Alice gets into this sort of mode, you're like, this is what people want. You know, this is the familiarity about it and what fans would have wanted. Sometimes you're like, even though you sort of curse that there's not more character development, sometimes you're just happy there isn't and wish there was more action, because whenever they do seem just to get into any dialogue, it always just feels so awkward and forced. I don't know. There's something about it, even though in a lot of times it comes in sort of short bursts because there's quite a lot of action. But a lot of other funny things too, like you're mentioning about her tying up the dogs. I'm like, it's just funny. As soon as you open the scene and you've got this convenient electric wire just hanging down, and you can see it a mile away. You're really setting this up for us.
It's a nice attention to detail. They put everything up on Front Street for you to see, so you know it's not just suddenly finding a wire dangling down, or she happens to grab something which opens up and wires happen to fall down from it.
Good point. I suppose I shouldn't criticize, because at least she's and that's the thing, it shows how resourceful Alice is, and god, she's pretty badass. You don't want to get on her wrong side, so and anything she can utilize to do her work, I suppose.
Absolutely. But I mean, what I did like, and look, I'm a sucker for anything that cuts in with a well-timed music sting, is when they fade out from Alice and go to the convoy led by Claire Redfield, I suppose our other main-ish character in the movie, and they're barreling down the road, running over zombies with the Ingarda da Vida playing at top volume as they're just casually radioing each other, asking if anyone's got any smokes. I'm thinking, oh, you got me. You got me with that musical sting.
Yep.
It suddenly increased my enjoyment at that time quite extensively.
And hey, we even needed it by this stage too.
Yeah, certainly lightened the mood and so injected a bit of fun, I guess, into proceedings that was probably needed at that point.
And it gives us a chance to, because that's the thing, if it had just been Miller pretty much, or Alice the entire movie, just fighting zombies and zombie dogs, it would have been quite boring. So it's good they've got this, I suppose, the paramedic crew or the army crew, whatever, as, you know, these supporting characters. But I actually find that the other actress, what did you say her name, her character was? With the hat.
Claire,
yeah. She actually reminds me a lot of Mila Jovovich. I mean, sorry, I've said the name, damn. Reminds me a lot of Alice. I don't know, not saying that they look that similar or anything like that, but yeah, they've very much got the same, they're very much the same type of person. So yeah, I was a bit confused at first, but that's okay. Especially when they're all dirty and stuff. But I was going to say, yeah, I do appreciate that when they're all just going through and just shooting it like it's become just a pastime now, you know. And of course, setting up the whole fact that where are the cigarettes? Because there's a couple of times, you know, we find later on that comes into play with a bit of the plot. But I think another girl stops at one of the cigarette machines and tries to get out a packet. So there's a couple of references there.
Yeah, they like their smokes, and a little implication that there may be something else they could smoke handy, but oh no, I took the last one, which again comes back later. So I get, like, you know, it just seems like a casual conversation, but again, it's just like, yeah, it's got those weird little attentions to detail, even though some subplots tend to kind of just get brought up and then put to the side, like the whole thing of naming one of the characters Kmart.
Oh, I know. That was, I actually had to rewind and play again. Did they say what I thought they said?
Yeah, she chose the name Kmart because they found her in a Kmart and everyone that she knew was already dead. So she decided she didn't want her old name anymore. And it was like, okay, this needs to be more than that. Are you going to make more of that? Are we going to go meet like Walmart at some
point?
No,
Macy's.
No, just one particular character called Kmart.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's like, did you need to throw this in? And it's funny because I don't know if that was supposed to be something that's, I don't know, humorous or people are supposed to get a little chuckle out of, because there was a little couple of times where they try in the dialogue to be funny. I think there's something a bit later on when one of, because there's always those scenes about them getting the tins of all, I don't know, pork and beans and whatever, the ration food that they're finding, and they don't know what's in the tins. But later on when they cut to that guy in the car and he's just like, oh, my tummy's not good. It's a bit upset from the pork and beans. And he says to the cowboy, how do you do it? He goes, I've had years of practice. Like, they'd stop and do things like that. I can't believe I managed to remember most of it like that. But yeah, it'll often stop and do that. And you think, I don't know if it's them trying to be funny and put these little extra bits in, which just weren't necessary.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole thing is it's a bit bizarre though, because as you mentioned, that guy who's unwell, because I mean, we have to have a spooky motel scene.
Oh, of course.
where everything seems fine, then suddenly let's have a jump scare as zombies start jumping out. And that one guy, he's not initially the token black character, at least until his girlfriend gets killed later in the movie, in the crow attack, which I know we'll get to.
Oh, that's...
But like, you know, the fact that he gets bitten and doesn't tell anyone, I think by this stage, you know, everyone would know what being bitten by one of these zombies would mean. So it almost turns him into a bad guy in that he's deceiving everyone about this zombie bite, because no particular reason, he just doesn't want them to know, even though he knows he's eventually going to turn into one.
Yeah.
At the most inconvenient time, which of course he does.
Yeah, as we find. But that's the thing. I don't know if it was around here. There's a section around here anyway where I think it might have been that, where they shoot one of the zombies in the chest rather than the head. And I don't know. It was just one of these things. I'm like, surely they know by now that you shoot them in the head. But yeah, I don't know if that was a bit later on, and I was a bit confused about that.
Yeah, I mean, there are things which are done, I think, more for movie convenience rather than logic. Let's put it that way.
Well, as you were saying earlier about them, you know, being the bloodiest sort of ones, you know, they didn't hold back. They were having, you know, you were seeing blades going through the heads of zombies, and yeah, they were having a great time throwing in as much as I could. But it's funny, like, it wasn't overly violent and graphic, though. That's the thing. Considering they're going, this is the bloodiest, but probably in comparison to the other ones, it definitely is.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few gruesome scenes. I think they did show some nice close-ups of people being eaten, and closest to people being pecked to death by birds. I think at one point when they run over a zombie and then they come through and they've got spikes on the wheels of some of the trucks.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And just which seems purely so they can run them through zombies, because there's no other practical use for those things.
Yeah, it's just like a Death Race 2000 all over again. It's a bit of fun there for them. But, yeah, so they're unsuccessfully trying to domesticate these zombies, and that's what we're very much the Day of the Dead sort of similarities are there, you know. But, yeah, so they're saying that, you know, Alaska, there's no virus. So pretty much that they decide to head there. But as I was saying before, that should have been something that the quest to go to Alaska should have probably come in a little bit earlier, but I suppose they had to set up all that other stuff. And in talking while we're around there and sort of a design aspect, I do like those scenes where they would show like a map and then it would segue into the actual scene itself. Not that it had too many touches like that, but little things like that I appreciated.
Yeah. A few times I was, scanning over the map of America and zoomed in. And there were multiple ones of going back to Umbrella's evil lair with Dr. Isaacs and getting like the digital representation of it. And it just zooms into whatever section that they want to be in. So it's nice, again, a nice way, I suppose, of creating scope and creating size for this vast underground base without actually needing to put too much scenery in there.
And also, too, when you've got, again, something based on a video game, when a premise that's quite small, you know, yeah, it's good when they can add all these extra touches in, and they sort of have to flesh it out. Flesh it out? I don't know if that's very... Is that a pun? I don't know.
It'll do. It's close enough.
So I think it was around the time... Yeah, we don't have to go in order as such, but I think it's around here when the sort of the crows zombie scene sort of starts, you know. And I don't know if it, like, I appreciated the zombie attack, but I don't know if it's just me. It seemed like it went on for a while, like longer than it should have. Like they could have, I don't know, utilized another attack scene, you know, a couple of minutes later in a sort of different circumstance, like basing it something off the game. I just thought the crow thing did go on for a little longer than expected. But yeah, I appreciate it, and especially now knowing only two crows were actually used and hopefully not harmed.
Yeah, I'm sure the crows are fine by the end of it. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing was really set up, I suppose, because you get the thing where the convoy's radio, the convoy is on the radio looking for other survivors, and it cuts to Mila off by a campfire by herself, and she just closes the radio down because, you know, it's never made clear the fact that I think a couple of the other survivors that she escaped with in number two are part of that convoy. It's not established until, I suppose, much later. So if you hadn't seen the movie before or in the previous movies, you wouldn't have known. I barely remember, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, don't look at me.
I'm pretty sure one of those guys was in the last movie, but I'm not 100% sure. And then, like, she doesn't actually team up with them until we get our reminder of her superpowers when she lifts everything around her and wrecks her bike while having a nightmare. And it's kind of all just conveniently set up to make everything look as bad as possible before she just steps up and saves the day.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I suppose, as I said before, that's what people seem to want to see, is her toting guns. And that's the thing. When she'd always be so clever with a lot of the actions she'd use with the guns. I think that's that typical one where she crosses it over like an X over her chest. I think that was used in possibly one of the posters for one of the other movies. But yeah, they're definitely pretty clever with what they come up with for her to do as well. So,
I mean, she ultimately saves them because I think they use a flamethrower on the birds. And of course, the guy in the flamethrower gets taken out pretty quickly, and then the flamethrower is just still firing even though there's no one pulling the trigger. I'm pretty sure flamethrowers don't work that way, but yeah. Hey, movies.
Yeah, and there's even that part where Scott, sorry.
Yeah, so yeah, and the flame then starts moving around to hone in on her friend from the last movie and his current girlfriend, and she turns up just in time to stop them being burnt to death using her superpowers. Which she then manages to set all the birds in the sky on fire with a lot of fire.
Yeah. Oh, and of course we get the typical shot, the bird's eye shot, I suppose you could say, of all of this happening too. But as you said, very much the movie thing. So yeah, when it's coming towards you and all that sort of stuff, yeah, pretty cool. But very CGI. And now that I know that a lot of the, well, I suppose, at least we know those two birds wouldn't have been in the flames. Those two birds, the real birds. But yeah, no, I did appreciate, you know, a lot of the angles. And even though there's something, I like, they had to make that run for it to the truck. And I do think it's funny them. Okay, what else would they do? But I mean, shooting the birds with the gun, I don't know. It just seems very ineffective. You're probably only getting one in every, I don't know, 20. But oh, well, they had to do what they can.
Yeah, and until Alice turned up to make barbecue bird time.
Yeah. Oh, and I think it was around there where she arrives, and I'm like, ah, that's the screenshot of the poster. I think, you know, when she's walking in the desert. Yeah. And as soon as I saw that, I'm like, ah, that's the poster pose.
That's the poster shot, absolutely. But then they sort of like justify why she hadn't been using her powers up to that point, because as soon as she uses her powers, back at the evil lair base, the little computer girl turns up and just goes, oh, we've detected the psionic activity. And they find her really, really quickly, because she's having a reunion with her friend, and then there's a shot of her being spied on by a satellite that just happens to be directly over her at just the right time.
Yeah,
convenient.
Yeah, they don't want to waste time in this movie. You know, they've only got an hour 27 or something. But yeah, I did think that too. You know, and I think it's around. I think it was in that scene where he goes, yeah, the zombies are turning aggressive and not domesticated. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm seeing where the extra threat is coming in. And I almost knew from this part on that he's going to get bitten and turn into a zombie. It just seems to be the given for a movie like this. So, but again, we're still only just deciding to go to Alaska. They do that whole thing when, you know, everyone votes where they want to go, and they pretty much all decide to go there. And I thought, oh, well, I'm kind of glad they decided to go to Alaska, or it would be pretty boring second half of the movie, or last half an hour.
Well, yeah, I mean, the decision to go to Alaska is a whole thing that predicates them going into Las Vegas, because they'd have been avoiding big cities, because that's, I guess, where most of the zombies would be. But you know, they don't have enough petrol to get to Alaska, so that means that they got to go there. But they get there, and Dr. Isaacs has set up a trap ready for them, despite being told by the big boss not to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, how did he know they were going to Las Vegas? That's the one. There's a big gap. He just puts a handy shipping crate in front of one place where they could get petrol from.
Yeah, that's right.
Out of all of Las Vegas, he just knows that that's the exact one they're going to go to. How? Why? When? What? How?
It's like he gets word as soon as they start moving and works pretty fast. But yeah, that does not make sense at all. it is funny sort of seeing Vegas like that, in terms of, you know, how it pretty much does have, you know, a version of the you know, the Eiffel Tower and all that sort of stuff. So that was kind of clever. And I think it gave them a chance to do some casino jokes, I suppose, in inverted commas there. And those, a few little jibes about the valet parking. Ha ha ha.
Oh, yo, how do you know this fellow poking? What, I lost 2 G's here. You're saying, what, you had to work?
Yeah.
What you're saying? You had to work as a valet because you lost $2,000? Was that the joke?
And then the guy's like, a joke. Yeah, and then the guy's kind of more like, oh, you only lost $2,000 or something like that. But yeah, any conversations between the cowboy and that guy in the car was totally unnecessary.
Yeah, there wasn't much. They didn't seem very friendly, and this is, you know, this is the guy who's been bitten by a zombie here, who's not looking very well.
Yeah.
But no one seems overly concerned about the fact that he's getting paler and more gaunt and looking more like a zombie as they go. Yeah,
the part that surprises me is in a lot of these other zombie movies, you know, they doesn't take them too long to sort of manifest into a zombie, but these ones, it seems a bit drawn out. Like, it's definitely a slow process.
But again, it's something that by this stage, these survivors would have seen what it looked like when somebody gets infected. And yet no one picks up the fact that this one guy, was it LJ or something like that?
Yeah, I think something
was
yeah.
his cool name. Yep, LJ. is being zombified before their eyes. It's like, come on, guys, really? You're cluier than this. You should know.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and always in these movies too. I always go back to the genre, I suppose. But there's always the character going, "No, I'm fine. Just keep going, guys." And you're like, "Yeah, you're about to turn to a zombie in any second." But we've just got to keep going because there's other things to do.
But yeah, I did like though when they're getting ready to move the shipping crate, that just happens to be in the middle of this desert for no apparent reason. They don't suspect it for a second until Alice goes up to it and she's listening to it, and there's this very like this slow motion dramatic build before it bursts open, and a hell of a lot of these enhanced super aggressive zombies come jumping out. But again, mainly just so we can see how the rest of the survivors don't deal very well against them, and yet Alice is there doing jumps and spins and using her jewel knives to just absolutely cut her way through all these zombies. Where many, it's like, are there any survivors going to survive this? Because it seems to take out pretty much everyone very, very quickly.
And it's the thing, whenever scenes like this, actually this is probably the penultimate, I think that's the word, I don't know, the main sort of scene, I think this is what people would have been expecting, is this that kind of fighting and that kind of gore. This particular scene would have been the one that I think sealed it for people, because, yeah, they didn't hold back at all. And as I said earlier, you know, blades going through heads and all sorts of things. And I think because they're zombies, you can kind of get away with it more without it being seeming as brutal. I know that sounds weird than if she was doing it to, say, humans. So I don't know. But one thing, I think it might have been that review you said earlier where they mentioned that the zombie effects weren't very good. And I'm like, well, I appreciated the ones in the early half of the movie. I don't know. I thought they were quite impressive, actually. But by the time we got to the second half, around this sort of one, I don't know. Maybe I was just used to them by now, but wasn't winning me over as much.
Well, because they were all identical. It was like, they all had, they didn't like seem to do any variation with the makeup for these guys that are running around and decimating the survivors. And they're all dressed identically. It's like, you couldn't have like put them in different survivor clothes or different clothes from wherever you got them from. They're all dressed in the exact same jumpsuits.
And like, I know zombies, you know, essentially have a stagger and a walk that they kind of do. Each of them still have their own personality, you know, as they had their own personality as a human. So surely they could have brought that to the part. Maybe the actors were just told, okay, stand over there and just act like a zombie. Go.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose a twist we get at this point, though, is as we, you know, they do talk a bit about Project Alice, I guess, during the movie, and they managed to turn off Alice via satellite, which was an interesting touch.
Yeah, because I think it pulled out of the, again, in one of those segue shots, it pulls out of the Earth and then shows you that satellite. And it's interesting because I thought for some reason it was going to start doing some kind of another recap or another kind of exposition from a narrator. But yeah, that's exactly what happens. They turn her off.
Yeah, And that's when we finally get to see that Claire and the other, I suppose, main character survivors, you know, they can still kick butt without Alice, even though it does get decimated. But I was a bit upset when the Aussie radio tech guy got taken down. I liked that guy. I think it was Christopher Egan. He is a known Australian actor.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, I know, I recognise that guy from somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's been in various soapies.
Okay.
In Australia. He's definitely one of the Home and Away alumni.
Oh, okay. It's probably that. I used to watch Home and Away many years ago, so maybe.
I mean, funnily enough, a lot of the Australian actors you see out and about now are Home and Away alumni. So
yeah, interesting. So yeah, so it makes sense he was there. But yeah, so he didn't really have too much to do in the movie. But yeah, he it's a shame he got wiped out.
Yeah, because he was I liked his character. You know, when you did get to see him doing his tech stuff and being the tech support guy, It's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I can believe that. That works well.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not Mikey.
That's it, Mikey. And and that's the thing. You almost need that kind of – you need a character in a movie like this, the guy, the tech nerd, I suppose you could call him.
They did manage to make suspenseful the struggle of Alice versus the satellite. Even though she's standing still and all they're doing is zooming in her eyes and you're seeing that umbrella symbol flicker in her pupil.
Oh, yeah.
Bloody umbrella symbol. Why do they put their umbrella symbol on everything? It just makes it so obvious they're the bad guys. They're not like a secret organization. Because everywhere you turn, there's a bloody great umbrella logo.
I know, but and at the same time, too, there's nothing really menacing about an umbrella, too, as a logo. I don't know.
Yeah.
I suppose, what else can you use if your company's called Umbrella, I suppose.
But yeah, you see, cut to Alice standing there, stock still, being totally ignored by the zombies, who could have like jumped her in like 2 seconds flat.
Yeah.
While she was immobile. Cut to the guys in the control room going, "Oh, she's fighting back! She's fighting back! Is she? Can we tell?" Cut to the satellite and a chip inside, and you just see it start popping slightly, and a little tendril of smoke appears. Cut back to Alice. Cut back to them. And it's like, that is cheesy as hell, but it works.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that's the thing we've got to think about with this movie. You're not expecting too much from it, I think. You know, you kind of want these cheesy sort of effects because, hey, it's a zombie movie based on a video game. So, yeah, I do appreciate when they still go for those sort of, they don't take themselves too seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, again, I don't know how Umbrella does so well and is so powerful because they make some very dumb choices. Let's set up our base where we're controlling our satellite, which is completely controlled remotely. Let's set up the base really close to where they're all fighting. Yeah. So that as soon as Alice escapes the clutches of the satellite, she knows exactly where we are because she traced the signal, I guess, and can come in and basically do a little bit of bad guy killing and good old Dr. Isaacs escapes at the last minute, but not before being bitten by one of his own zombies.
Whoa. Oh,
what's going to happen there?
Yeah, because of course he's got to turn into a zombie, huh? Even though he almost seems, you know, in the way of his acting, he seemed already a bit zombie-like anyway. But I think with him again, he starts to look very, very pale, but it would have been better if he started to look, I don't know, even more sicker than the other zombies. I don't know, just to highlight he was the bad guy. But I'll take it for what it was.
yeah, gets back and overdoses on the antidote they've been working on, which instead of basically lets him, I suppose, maintain control while he turns into the big mutated bad guy. There it is. We knew it was coming at some point.
Especially when, I don't know, some kind of weird octopus thing or something like that. He's got these, I don't know, I'm assuming straight out of the video game, that character.
Well, yeah, definitely inspired by some of the bosses in the video game. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and it works because you always think in these movies, I mean, sorry, in video games, anything sort of based on that, yeah, you need to have that boss level, which is essentially what this is, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, before we get to that, When LJ finally turns zombies and he bites Alice's friend from the previous movie. So that sets up, the big buff dude who knows he's doomed can heroically sacrifice himself for everybody else so that they can get access to this helicopter. You know, all very handy and convenient.
Yeah, and and pretty much to bring us to the part with her in walking down the halls again, and I felt like we're watching the first movie all over again. You know, that part where she sees her doppelgangers and all that.
Yeah, she comes across herself, a nude version. She actually looks really impressed and really happy when she finds a nude version of herself floating in a ball of fluid.
Yeah. It's like, oh, at least you've done a good job with the clones. You just haven't stuffed my body up too much and put the wrong the wrong body with the wrong head or something. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is also after the scene where she comes across the trench full of dead versions of herself.
Yeah, and which I think it's good that she got a chance to see all that, because I don't know, I actually think they should have kept the reveal. I know we needed to know the clones earlier on, and we could see the pile of the clones, but I don't know, it would have been good if they'd left it to this, as it was a big reveal, you know, for us as well.
I can only imagine what Mila's I think as a person, when Mila saw the shots of all the dead versions of herself, I'm guessing that would have been quite a confronting scene once she saw it post production.
Yeah, get what you mean too. So, but yeah, and then we find out that her blood has, I suppose, the elements to make a cure, and you know that's the reason why all the, you know, they've been able to make all the clones. Is that?
Yeah, they were making the clones because they thought that that would be make the cure, but the clone versions weren't quite right, which is why Dr. Isaacs wanted to I think the line back in the Las Vegas fight was that that, you know, once she's dead, move quickly. We need to get her blood while it's still warm. Yep, you're a bad guy. Ian Glenn playing the usual super calm, collected bad guy.
Well, I just thought it was funny how the creepy little girl turns up, when we find out about the whole blood situation, and then she goes, "You've got everything you need to make the serum," and you're just kind of thinking, "Oh, I don't think we have that much time." But anyway.
Let's set up everything right now towards the end of the movie, because it's blatantly obvious that, you know, this movie is running out of time to try to resolve all these plots. So it's like, wow, this one's really being set up for a sequel, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's one thing I noticed, you know, about this movie. It always had that feeling, you know, like it was never going to complete itself. You always, and that's the thing. I think you could still feel like you'd seen a complete movie, I suppose, if you were only watching the one film. But, it definitely feels like that in the second half, and a lot of loose ends. Like they literally did run out of time and go, whoop, we've got to keep it under that hour and a half, Mark.
Yeah, because, just to quickly recap, I suppose, what happens towards the end. Something gets bumped and the clone Alice comes out of a bulb and then apparently dies in real Alice's arms. So she just leaves her with a jacket over the top of her. Has fight scene, which goes very badly for real Alice until they end up in the laser grid corridor again. They love that so much in the Resident Evil movies.
Yep.
And when it activates, it slices through the bad guy and stops just before it hits Alice, because clone Alice is really still alive and she turned it off just in time.
Oh, yeah.
Then they get to team up and they have a pan out of like all these other clone Alices sitting in their in their bulbs of liquid and lots of Mila.
Well, I even like that shot where, you see her standing next to her clone, and they just sort of look each other up and down and then back again, you know, that kind of realism of, oh yeah, what would happen if you encountered a whole heap of yourselves, especially ones that are actually alive now? That'd be good. But yeah. It's funny how the movie opens and closes with Mila Jovovich pretty much naked.
I mean, look, I don't want to sound misogynistic, but I don't mind Mila naked.
And hey, this is her movie, and she knows what the fans want too. They all want just that, but it's definitely, it knows its target audience as well.
Anyway, so and then it fades to black. No one's made it to Alaska. There's a few subplots that have just been left hanging.
Yeah,
and we get a cover version of White Rabbit.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it took me a while, but do you know when you hear lyrics at first and go, what is, yes. So I think it ended up being two songs in total, but it just, I don't know, for some reason those songs just reeked of something from a 90s movie soundtrack, like The Craft or something like that.
Oh, yeah, the second song that came in, I don't know what it was, but I could have done without it.
Yeah, it's again, as we said, you know, I think the end credits go for about 7 minutes. So, nice short movie, but and no stinger, unfortunately, at the end.
No, we did, of course, through to the very, very end, which means, Christian, we have gotten to the very, very end of our chat. We have some business to do now.
I know, yeah. So, very interesting talking about this, and I'm still in two minds about, let's just say. So making a final decision as we chat.
Fair enough. Well, I did pick this movie, so you better decide pretty soon. Because, Christian, I need to ask you, was there anything redeemable about this movie? And would you say it was, whether or not it was redeemable overall?
Okay, well, yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, not my particular genre. I appreciate zombie film, you know, I appreciate the genre. And I keep mentioning, you know, how, you know, the genre as such, but, you know, these are very much a homage to those original movies like Day of the Dead. Look, I found, I said earlier, the whole trip to Alaska should have been this big plot point where, you know, pretty much a road trip movie, you know, where they're stopping and fighting all these bad guys along the way. But instead, they sort of bring the Alaska trip in sort of halfway into it, or maybe two quarters of the way through, and it's just so underwhelming. You know, it's proof again, I think, that games to film are really tricky. You know, you've got a very small short story that you've got to flesh out, you know, from this really tiny premise. So it's a tricky one. Okay, Trevor, I'm very much on the edge because it's not my genre, it's not something that I would normally suss out. But you know what, Trevor, I actually think because it's short and sweet and doesn't outstay its welcome and achieves what essentially it's supposed to achieve, you know, from something like this, I think it's just redeemable. And I mean just. On the cusp.
Wow. Well, I am definitely, you know, I'm pretty much on that cusp level as well. I mean, this was definitely a Resident Evil movie. I would say it was better than the first one, but I believe that we consider the first one was not redeemable. So at least it's gone up. It was up and down, though. There were some sequences that lifted the movie up. But they were balanced out with stretches that were pretty formulaic, not very exciting, or both. I mean, look, multiple Milas is a nice addition. Gotta say that. But finishing the movie with an obvious setup for the next film without actually resolving any of the subplots, it felt a bit cheap. So this is a borderline movie, and look, I was on the edge, and it was a cover version of White Rabbit that I absolutely love that song that just pushes it past the post for me to make it redeemable.
Oh, wow. I wasn't sure how this was going to go, Trevor. But, yeah, it sounds like we found a couple of things within that movie that we could, you know, enjoy, you know, but I don't think I'd rush to see it again.
Yeah. I don't think I'll need to revisit it before we watch the next one next year.
No. Hey, at least you can use the fact that we redeemed the last Resident Evil, as in this one. So it might be a reason to check out the next one.
Yeah, well, currently the season is going 2 redeemable, 1 not, and there's 3 to go.
Interesting.
Okay, so look, we just redeemed this. It was a very close call. But with all these movies, God bless them, there are fans out there. So I do like to finish on a nice positive note. So I've dug up another review from Amazon. This one is titled Another Great Sequel in a Great Series. This series just keeps getting better with each sequel. And I love this one because it expanded more on the character of Alice and her superhuman abilities. And it also introduced the idea of a cure, well, somewhat, for the T-Virus. The whole Resident Evil storyline gets better with each movie, but the fact that the directors are not permanent does kind of take away from everything. But overall, this was a great movie with a great cast and killer crows and should not be missed. Also, check out the other movies in this series. 5 stars.
Interesting. Oh, well, as you said before, you either love it or hate it, even though, ironically, we end up right in the middle.
Yeah. Oh, you know, we're taking a more scientific approach.
Well, a less biased, perhaps. And hey, maybe if I'd remembered the first 2 movies enough, I may have been able to weigh in a little bit more. But as a standalone, yeah, we made it.
Just made it over the
edge.
Okay, well, there we go. We managed to redeem Resident Evil Extinction. Quite an achievement, I think, actually. I'm proud of that. And we do, though, need to look at what we're looking at next time, Christian, and I believe it's your turn.
Oh, wow, yes. And I think we probably should get out of the post-apocalyptic genre for a little bit. I know it's been sort of unintentional, but yeah. I'm going to completely mix it up. And look, I'm actually pretty proud of myself. I've been recommending sort of more modern movies recently, but I think it's time we go back to something a bit retro, I think, or something a bit pre-90s, you know. And these are always hard movies to look at because, you know, a lot of times two things are dated, you know, possibly in a bad way, but you've got to look at these movies kind of objectively and stuff. But we're going to go back to 1975. This was a hard one to choose. I actually made the decision while we were talking. So We're going to watch a 70s musical because it's been a while, Trev, and I can't think of anything. Can't think of anything further away from a post-apocalyptic movie. Now, this movie, I've actually only seen bits of it before, but what can you resist when the review of this movie is, this may be the worst movie musical of this or any other decade. It was one of the worst bombs of the 1970s, and it was a musical, so it could be anything there. So, but when you've got a musical that features the music of Cole Porter, okay, pretty iconic music from the 30s, mm-hmm. but we've also got a cast. Might add, this is a musical that stars Burt Reynolds, Sybil Shepherd, and Madeleine Kahn. We're looking at the 1975 Peter Bogdanovich movie At Long Last Love, which has recently just been re-released after them burying it for many, many years. But this was a huge, huge bomb.
Wow, I am completely unfamiliar with this one. I'm trying to do my quick search to see where it can be watched, and I'm coming up with no results.
Yeah, I think it actually was released on Blu-ray recently in a very, very rare edition. So it might be a hard one to find, but that could also be, let's just say, is it Paramount who's distributed? That could be 20th Century Fox trying to bury that, I think.
That's all good. Well, it's safe to say that if people want to watch this before our next podcast, you're on your own, guys. Good luck with that. At Long Last Love. I've just got the IMDb page open now.
Pretty impressive cast. You've also got Eileen Brennan from Clue. And as I said, Madeleine Kahn also from Clue. So, yeah, and people playing people that aren't necessarily singers. So, and you know how that can go in some respects with musicals. So, mm-hmm. think Mamma Mia and a few other things like that. So,
I'm thinking Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, exactly. So I think we're going down that sort of angle, but using iconic Cole Porter songs from the 20s and 30s, you know, brought into a modern sort of setting, essentially kind of like a Moulin Rouge type film. So I'm interested to see the whole thing and see if it really is the bomb that everyone says it was.
Yeah, well, you know me, I'm always game. I have no idea what to think about this one. It's very white in its photos, yeah. Like lots of white drapes in the background and white outfits and white tails. It's like, wow.
Yeah. Okay. I'm reading through the reviews at the moment going, yeah, it's like it's referred to as a stillborn musical comedy.
Mm. Oh.
that's not good.
That's well, I'm always up for a challenge, and I'm always up for something completely new. So it sounds like you've given me both of those.
Yeah, and as I said, I've probably seen about 10 minutes of this movie. I don't know if that says something about it. But so I'm looking forward to visiting this. So and I thought something totally different to what we've looked at recently.
Absolutely. At Long Last Love. Give it a go.
Good luck with that.
So there we go. Now, if anyone out there has seen At Long Last Love and would like to let us know what you think of it before our next podcast, or if you want to comment on Resident Evil Extinction, do you think we were too generous? Do you think we were too harsh? We would love to know. So you can get in touch with the Rufus Project super duper easy. You can find the Rufus Project on Facebook and Twitter. You can find our homepage at rufusproject.com and leave a comment there, or you can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com. We would love to hear from you. Now, moving on from that, if you want to see some good cult movies, I'll put the good in quotes because I know some of the ones that are coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
Christian Fletcher puts on wonderful events around Brisbane. So, Christian, what have you got coming up for us?
Well, I can guarantee not necessarily movies that are Rufus Project redeemable movie or irredeemable movies. But, we've got some great cult classics coming up like Pink. I mean, sorry, Pink. Pretty in Pink, the John Hughes classic, Clue, as I mentioned before, from 1985, and the 50th anniversary of Barbarella, which I suppose I think we might need to look at that down the track as well. We also have the return of comedy commentary cinema. We're looking at the 1979 blaxploitation film Disco Godfather, another film which could possibly be on this podcast. A lot of my retro nights are rounding up for the year. I've got my last ones at the New Farm Bowls Club, 70s and 80s on the 15th of September, and 60s and 70s on the 20th of October. And Trevor and myself will also be appearing in the Interactive Rocky Horror Picture Show on the 21st of September. But so check out Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook or christianfletcher.com for more upcoming events and details.
Absolutely. And like, if you can get to the Chanel Cinema on the 21st of September, please do. The Cards for Sorrow Rocky Horror screenings are absolutely awesome. And I've been in the audience and on stage, so I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and you've been there since the beginning, Trevor, so we can speak from experience.
And for everything Rufus Project related, I would say keep an eye on our Facebook page. It's probably your best source of info. I thought I was going to have more time to do stuff, but for some reason my spare time is very much filled up. So I do promise to bring more stuff to our YouTube channel in the very near future. I'm gearing up to do some more one credit challenges, which are always super duper fun. That's where I play an old retro arcade game and see how I go with just one credit.
Ooh, I definitely recommend that too. And that's the thing.
Exactly what it sounds.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's so much diverse things under the Rufus Project banner. So we've got bad movies to video games to What the History as well. A bit of a segue there.
Yeah, What the History, if you want to check that out. I do that with my wife, Susie. She's currently overseas, so we've had to take a brief break, but we are coming up to our second birthday episode. So that's always a good listen, where we have a look. It's a bit of a longer one, that one. We have a look at the past year and pick out our favorite bits of What the History from our past 12 months. And we normal episodes are us doing two little bizarre bits of history to make you say What the History. They're usually about 20 minutes, and they are a great casual listen and also family friendly.
Yeah, definitely recommended. And I can't believe it's been 2 years already. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I it's like, wow, that's coming up fast.
Yeah,
wow. You've got to get organized for that. Oh my God.
And then I think about the redeeming features, and I think to myself, like, the amount of movies we've done here, God, the time just flies. But as listeners can also revisit any of those movies or any of those chats at any time, because there's been some corkers in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. If you head to the rufusproject.com, there's a little link on the side to say what movies have we redeemed, which will take you to a handy page with a breakdown of movie by season of the podcast, and then you can just click through to the relevant podcast there. Make it easy for you. Hope you appreciate it.
And we always welcome the recommendations for movies, even though we've still got many more we need to tackle, I'm sure.
And more keep popping out of the work.
No, like this next one we're looking at. So I surprised myself with that. So
absolutely. So I think it's time to bring this chat to an end. The movies may or may not be redeemable. We got lucky this time, but I love these chats so much.
Oh, always good. Hey, I wish that could be a movie and it would be redeemable.
Absolutely. Cool. So we will be back in a couple of weeks' time to talk At Long Last Love from 1975. I'm already cracking up about that one. And we will catch you all then. See you later.
Creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm BB, said it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Reading teachers.